Hello! Welcome to episode 10 of the War Pod, the official podcast of the Remote Warfare Program, part of the Oxford Research Group. The Remote Warfare Program is a London-based research initiative focusing on remote warfare, the trend where states support local and regional forces on the front lines rather than deploying large numbers of their own troops. I'm Megan Kalso-Peterson, a research and policy officer at the Remote Warfare Program. In this episode, I'll be joined by my colleague, Liam Walpole, policy manager, as well as Josh Arnold Forster, who was special advisor to Defense Secretary John Reid in 2005-2006 and is a senior advisor at Hanover Communications. We'll be discussing the Integrated Security, Defense, and Foreign Policy Review, which, luckily for those of us who discuss it often, has simply come to be known as the Integrated Review. So, Liam, can you give a quick introduction to the Integrated Review and its importance for the Remote Warfare Program?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's quite strange that I'm starting off with this question. We've got someone with us who is obviously an expert on all these things. But I suppose, actually, we only after the last couple of days, we understand a bit more about what this review is going to focus on and the parameters of the review. But effectively, this is going to be an all-encompassing review covering foreign policy, security policy, and defence policy. It's going to be called the Integrated Review. And I suppose it's an important step, I suppose, primarily for two reasons. And I think one of them is that the UK hasn't had a strategic defence review since 2015. And it's usually the case that it happens on a five-yearly cycle. And we're going to get to that in a moment. And I think the second point is that with the UK leaving the European Union, there is an opportunity to think quite extensively about what that actually means. And I think we look at what the governments or governments of the last sort of 3 years, 4 years have been talking about, and they speak about global Britain, but there hasn't really been much meat on the bones about what that really means. And we know already that this review apparently wants to look at the UK playing a more active role on the international stage, whatever that means. So I think, you know, it's a good sort of navel-gazing exercise in a way to think about, well, what actually do many of these things mean. I think from the perspective of the Remote Warfare Programme at the Oxford Research Group, you know, we've been looking at, as I say, remote warfare, the way in which we've been partnering with other states rather than sort of deploying large numbers of our own troops. And I think this is a real opportunity to look at, well, how do we do that in the most effective way? What are the lessons of, you know, recent conflicts? What lessons can we learn in terms of, well, how do you do protection of civilians when it comes to partnered operations? How are you building the capacity of these different countries in a way that does actually meet some of the sort of goals of that the UK has had over the last couple of years when it comes to building stability overseas? I think integrating all those lessons into this review will be really important from our perspective.
Absolutely. And so maybe on that note, Josh, can you perhaps start off by telling us a bit more about the real purpose of these reviews that come around every 5 years?
Well, the stated purpose of these reviews is to look at the likely risks to UK national security and then implement the necessary policies to mitigate those risks. This review, as Liam has said, is slightly different because it is broader. You know, we're getting, you know, the Department of Biz and the Home Office and departments that you wouldn't normally expect to be involved in the review. We're also looking at, I mean, it's looking at serious and organised crime, so it's a very wide spectrum. So normally these reviews, though, I mean, yes, they are set up, that is their principal purpose, but they also have a political purpose, which is to present governments' defence and security policies in the best possible light, and, you know, this will be the same as all the other ones, I would assume, in that sense. There's some interesting language in what the Prime Minister announced yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of opportunities as well as risks, and that's potentially quite interesting. Potentially, there's opportunities for the UK to do things that perhaps we haven't done in the past and do them in different ways. Now, whether that works out that way, who knows? But I think one of the things that all reviews always emphasize is new technology. Yeah. I mean, they always talk about new technology. They always talk about how that will change everything. And, you know, that's how they, that's, I mean, and in that sense, It is similar. I mean, it is broader. There's some different language in there, but in a way, there's a lot of similarities. Also, these reviews always take place immediately after an election,
yeah.
And there's a debate about the democratic accountability of having a review immediately after election rather than just before.
Yeah.
So, you know, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah, maybe on that note, actually, can you tell us more about the political climate that those reviews take place in? Or maybe ask in a different way, who are the personalities that are behind it? So in regards to, we've heard a lot, we've spoken about this before as well, there seems to be quite a lot of political personalities behind the reviews.
Oh, yes. No. I think well...
Who we're talking about?
I couldn't imagine who you're talking about. I mean, we have a very sort of demonstrative government. They really want to demonstrate a whole range of things.
Yeah.
And I think in this context, they want to demonstrate that they're going to be transformative. Mm-hmm. They're going to introduce new technology. They're going to use big data, et cetera, to solve all these problems. You know, and all more power to their elbow. They have a sizable majority, which in the British political system means that, you know, as long as your party discipline is relatively structured, then you can, you know, there's a lot of scope to do all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about this government is they've already demonstrated that they can ignore some of the traditional constraints that British governments feel that they are under. And all of these constraints are usually unwritten, so they can just rip them up if they want. And so they may be doing some quite radical things. And don't forget also that traditionally, right-wing governments can do things that look very left-wing, mm-hmm. and vice versa. So you may see some really interesting, you know, work done on remote warfare. I mean, the report you guys have done on fusion is reverberated around Whitehall. So, you know, we'll see whether actually you get Dominic Cummings knocking on your door saying, mm-hmm. come in and talk to us.
I mean, I think what was interesting, I don't know what you think about this, but there did seem to be a very open commitment for wider consultation with this review. And I mean, we were discussing this in our sister podcast, if you like, the Westminster Roundup, and whether this, you know, is only wider in the set relative to what the consultation was in 2015 or with the mini STSR. I mean, and one of the things that we've been looking at, and there's been a lot of talk around in the media that the 98 review is going to be sort of the blueprint when it comes to a wider consultation.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was looking through in preparation for this podcast, looking at the foreword that George Robertson wrote for the 98 review. And he sort of, you're absolutely right, you know, he talks about technology is like his race ahead, and that, you know, there's going to be potentially systematic attacks on computer networks. I mean, the terminology is slightly different today, talking more about cyber, but it's interesting how maybe this 98 review is going to be sort of, that was very transformational, wanted to be very transformational, sort of moving beyond sort of the Cold War kind of perception of the world. And it seems like there is an effort potentially to be as transformational, but in respect to the UK's position outside the EU.
Yes, I think that the 98 review did set out a course which was you know, significantly different from the traditional way in which Britain had structured its defence policy, to take the opportunities that the end of the Cold War had opened up and hadn't really been followed up by the previous administration.
Mm.
Of course, whether that was actually implemented is a whole other
thing. I do
take your point. And the consultation process was certainly far more open than the 2010 or the 2015 review. And I was at the corner of a table in King Charles Street for one of those consultations. And the thing about those consultations is, on the one hand, you know, you get a lot of very bright external people in the room, and you get some really good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
How many of them, I mean, I'm not sure how many of them ended up in the review. And then, of course, you know, there is this view that there's an old Whitehall view that you never open a consultation until you worked out what the results are going to be.
Yeah.
But on this one, again, you look at Dominic Cummings' writings and some of the other people involved in this, and you think, actually, no, they really do want to challenge the establishment. And That's why they want to bring in external experts, and that's to be encouraged, I would suggest. Question is, well, firstly, how do you select those external experts? Yeah. And you know, there's and that also, I think, so for instance, when it comes to remote warfare, you know, you do want to look at the people who really understand what's been happening, what's been going on, and you know what, and the, I think one of the problems that bringing external experts can bring is they are, you know, they have these ideas about technology and they have these ideas about new ways of working, which in the end actually are just unachievable. They can't be done. But nevertheless, I mean, let's see how they do it. Let's see how it goes. It is a very broad scope of you know, the sorts of things they want to do.
Yeah.
It's a really broad scope of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that in itself is a challenge for consultation, isn't it? Because no doubt there are going to be complaints from some groups that they're not consulted, but how does a government ensure that there's effective consultation internally among all the different departments, you know, making sure that fusion works, that departments with different cultures, different languages, different priorities speak to each other and can work together to put forward this new national security approach or new foreign policy approach. And whether that's going to be a challenge, isn't it, for the government to... Because they're equally... Usually, someone like Roussy or Chatham House, who's sort of very much established kind of voices on these things, would be consulted, and then others would complain, well, you're just sort of consulting to the converted. So I think it is going to be a challenge to get that consultation right, but also make sure, as you say, that's fed in an effective way, because it's probably quite a daunting task for any government to face that wide consultation.
Absolutely. And I think especially as well as we see already rumours of not only... disagreements between the different departments, but also within departments, of the MOD having different branches that are all arguing about what's actually going to be in this review. And so having that on top of all these external groups saying we'd like to be involved and we have a lot of knowledge that we've built over the years, can you please be part of the process? So it is a lot of actors trying to get together in one room, definitely. Yeah.
Especially in a 6-month turnaround.
Yeah, it's very short.
Well,
what do you think about that?
My experience of these sorts of reviews is always, we can do this in 6 months. We never do. It's complex and it's difficult. And also all these reviews and the structure for this review in terms of how they make the decision looks pretty similar to previous reviews, which is they will gather all the, you know, do all the analysis, come up with some recommendations. And then the people who are actually going to make the decision are a relatively small number of people. The problem with that is those small number of people won't be engaged in the work. And they'll get this document and they'll think, no, that's not what I want. And they'll say, go away and do it differently for whatever reason. So they do tend to always extend longer than people think. So we'll see. I mean, this is a government who's does have a, you know, they're ideologically in a different place to any previous government I've ever seen. They are not traditional Tories. I mean, that's very clear. What I find fascinating about them is that they have this blend of, you know, quite evident libertarianism. I mean, you see it in a lot of the published works members of the cabinet written before they got into the cabinet, and you see it in some of the statements. You see it in this sort of emphasis on free trade as the sort of almost the pinnacle of what Britain should be about. And yet they've also come to power on the wave of a fairly, you know, populist nationalism, which how do you merge those two different strands of ideology? And that's going to be a challenge for them, I think. We'll see how it goes.
I mean, you can always see that, can't you, with the budget. There are constraints about what they're thinking is acceptable to do, but in a way that's not sort of contradicting I suppose, what they've been talking about for the last 9 years about getting the deficit down and everything else, but also understanding that they very much seem to believe that these votes are borrowed in the North, don't they? And they want to appeal to them through spending, which puts the Conservatives in a very difficult position because, as I say, it sort of goes against everything that they've sort of been peddling for the last 9 years. So it's going to be interesting how that affects sort of political discourse over the next decade, I think.
Absolutely. And so if you two were to write the integrated review, what would be your main focus for each of you?
Wow.
That's
a big question. I mean, I suppose from our perspective, I just want to talk about one issue, and I think that is around the consultation. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, the greatest aspiration for this review is that they do consult more widely than they have done in the previous reviews. And I think, you know, speaking to the 98 review, I think that's a good basis for broader consultation. I think if you look at the Modernising Defence Programme, the National Security Capabilities Review, there did seem to be a lack of engagement. And I think also we've seen sort of mood music, and Megan, you were at the event at RUSI last week with the launch of the Strategic Command, mm-hmm. replacing the Joint Forces Command, where they did talk about, you know, the role of special forces. And, you know, this is an issue that we bang on about all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there is clear evidence that, for example, special forces have been increased, deployments have been increasing over the last decade. And I think, you know, given James Heapy, the Minister for the Armed Forces, speech the other day talking about we need to think differently about how that capability is deployed in the future, it seems peculiar that he's able to get up in front of a crowd at RUSI and talk about special forces, but then MPs in the House of Commons don't have a forum for talking about special forces. And I think also looking at the commitments that were made in the 2015 SDSR about increasing spending on special forces, among other things, for around 2 billion, looking at, well, how has that worked? There's also been discussions about changing the Royal Marines, making them less like the army, and perhaps creating a new unit which is effectively special forces. There's no public discussion, no political discussion about that, but it's already being steamrolled. So I think there are, obviously that's a small part of the UK's foreign policy, but I think there are important elements in terms of our work. And then the last point I'll make is that I think we really need to have a really thorough discussion about what our values are and how they are balanced with our national security interests. Because I think there is a tendency, or there has been a tendency over the last couple of years, if not the last couple of decades, for the UK to sort of pander to the rafters about certain issues, appearing that it is, you know, really pro human rights and pro democracy around the world, but then doing things that completely undermine that. You know, the response to the Russian attack in Salisbury, in comparison to the response to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by one of our closest partners, was quite stark. And I think we have to be clear, if we are going to be global Britain, if we are going to be a force for good in the world, which I think the government says it wants to be, then there has to be concrete examples of how that's going to happen in reality. And of course, crises happen and there are challenges and foreign policy is messy. But I think we need to be a little bit more thorough in how we go about really upholding this so-called global Britain and who we are as a nation.
Absolutely.
I think the issue of values is always one of those central things which we never really properly define. And maybe we will this time round, I don't know. I mean, I think what there's three things that I would like to see the review address. One is the issue, is following up the report you did on Fusion Doctrine. Yeah. I want to see how they're going to do that effectively, in a timely fashion. Everybody knows the obstacles. There are already some examples in the system that for particular regions, I think, which maybe provide a broader model. We need to iron out all of those, you know, mm-hmm. the cultural issues, the fiscal accountability stuff, all of that stuff is not, it's not rocket science. It can be done. The second one, I do take your point about the different responses between what the Saudis did allegedly did, and what the Russians definitely did. But I am concerned about our I don't think we are prepared as a nation for the impact, the ongoing impact of Russian and Chinese information and influence activities, both here in the UK, but also I think in Africa and in other parts of the world. Because whenever you go to any of these parts of the world, you see very active involvement. And, you know, maybe, you know, some of the things the Chinese are doing in Africa, you've got to say, well, you know, that's a good thing. Bugging the headquarters of the Organization of African Unity, maybe not. But we need to think about this, and we need to be active on this. And then finally, the thing that I really hope they do, but I'm not going to hold my breath, is they need to really look at climate change as a national security issue. You cannot move now in the Ministry of Defense for senior people saying this is a national security issue. The flooding, that, you know, there's a whole range of different negative impacts on the UK that come from climate change.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's refugee flows, and there's a whole bunch of things, and we really need to address that as a national security issue. So those are the things I'd like to see.
Would that be quite revolutionary in terms of thinking about security, having that climate element?
No, not at all, really. If you look at the work of the Development Concepts Defence... Oh, God, I can never remember what it's called.
DCDC.
That's the one. Their Global Strategic Trends document has been highlighting that for the last two decades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's we and you know, most people in mod who think long-term always recognise that. And it's about saying, right, there is a reason, you know, there is a very pragmatic, very important reason why we need to think about it, as well as all the other issues, but it does impact on our security.
That makes a lot of sense. I think maybe going back to your second point as well about remote warfare in regions that we don't think about very often, like Africa, I think it's really important to note that even as we see this focus on great power competition, it's more likely that the UK will continue to face Russian and Iranian-backed allies in the Sahel and in the Horn of Africa and in Syria rather than in the Baltics.
Yeah.
And there are these challenges to actually having a full-on war. So it seems more likely to continue to be through partnered operations. And so learning the lessons in the last two decades and trying to apply that to how we're going to continue to go to war is quite important.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think you guys have pointed out that actually when it comes to the Russians, you know, we're far more likely to meet them in somewhere like Syria and somewhere like that. And one of the things I hope the review does is actually really look very carefully at the Syrian experience, and we should not be afraid to say we got it wrong, but we must actually look at how the Russians have done what
they've
done. And it's a complex operation, and it's not simply about what they've done in Syria, but how they've influenced everybody around Syria and across the world to look at to see Syria in a different way. And we have to consider how that impacts on our security going forward.
Well, on that point, it's quite interesting because the new chair of the Defence Committee, Tobias Elwood, has been quite critical of the UK's inadequate response, in his view, to the crisis in Syria. And he talks a lot about the sort of hangover from Iraq, meaning that there is significant political risk aversion when it comes to you know, the UK being able to, or other nations being able to deploy force overseas. And I suppose he would say that the fact that we weren't able to perhaps launch a significant military operation in Syria meant that we weren't able to be as impactful. Now, I suppose we would probably potentially challenge the idea that you would have resolved that through greater military force, learning all the lessons from previous campaigns. But I wonder what specifically would have been the alternative, given that I think this is still something that, you know, ministers, politicians are grappling with in terms of, well, if we can't deploy our own forces on the ground, and we know that actually there are distinct challenges with looking like an occupying force, but if we then engage through partners, there are clear challenges of doing so. You're working with, you know, often corrupt regimes, weak security partners. What is the answer? You know, this is a challenge that perhaps also should be part of of the review about how do you get remote warfare right? Because in principle, it makes sense that you empower local actors, right? But it has to be done in a responsible way. And there's evidence that it's not being done in a responsible way. So what is, it's not necessarily that we need more military resources, but it's how we're applying diplomacy, how we're deploying development aid, all these different things, which links back to that fusion argument. And sometimes I think we learn the wrong lessons and we think, well, oh, well, that didn't go well because we didn't deploy enough troops. But actually it was a failure of diplomacy as much as it was a military operation. I think many people in the military will actually say that the counter-Daesh campaign, for example, was a successful military operation. It's been politically terrible, but militarily they might argue that it was an effective campaign.
Well, I think they would.
Tough questions. But.
No, that's not tough. I mean, and they're very important questions because... it's, you know, the traditional military response to a conflict is, yes, you know, deploying more force. But more and more people in the military appreciate that's not the case. And you will find, you know, a lot of the senior military officers now who've been in it, who served in Afghanistan would say, yeah, it's a failure of diplomacy. No, but one of the issues about working with partners, which is always, I mean, you're the experts in this area, but it's always struck me that, you know, there you are, you're working with a partner and they have all these issues about corruption or human rights abuses. And these are not things that the traditional soldier can teach one of their counterparts in a foreign country. You need a much more comprehensive package, that fusion approach. Yeah. But I think it needs to go beyond just DFID and the FCO. We need to start, you know, the Ministry of Justice sends British judges all over the world all the time. How do they coordinate that work with the work of the Defence Engagement Team or the work of the FCO or the work of DFID? Or we need to look really carefully at London as a financial centre and the way in which corruption does seem to be associated with London. Now, that's maybe unfair, but that's definitely
I think there's good evidence.
For it.
Yeah.
And therefore, the more we can think about it probably will involve new legislation, but we need to think about that in a much more coordinated way, because at the moment, unexplained wealth orders... we've only done one, and they're certainly not being, you know, it's a purely sort of domestic criminal thing that we're doing. Yeah. We should be looking at that in a much more holistic sense. We should be looking at how we manage these proceeds of corruption so that we can identify them and at the right moment respond to whatever findings come from the country where they came from to say, can you send them back, for instance?
Yeah.
And the same with human rights. How you educate a military that is not used to human rights law is not going to be done in a 6-month deployment. It's going to be done over 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an entire cultural shift for that military to start respecting, you know, doing protection of civilians in the way that we wish to do it. And you have to think long term. And above all, that's the thing about fusion that I think will be the key to its success, is you say, right, this is a 20-year program.
Yeah.
We need to think far, far, much, much more longer term than we have. And in the context of remote warfare, I would suggest that actually there is a high degree of cross-party consensus about the sorts of things we need to do. I don't think there is... We can't let the old argument of, oh, it's only 5 years and we can't think about the future. We can't let that pass. And we don't do that in other areas of policy. We shouldn't do it in fusion.
And I suppose actually that's one of the reasons why... And I know this is something that happened in the 98 really, but thinking about what the public think about defence as well. You know, there's always this discussion that, well, you don't win votes with defence. But if to be successful, we have to have this long-term approach, then you're going to have public buy-in so that they understand and actually awareness that we are deployed in these particular countries for X reasons, because I don't think there is sufficient understanding either of you know, some of these places we're engaged. I mean, if you spoke to the Tom, Dick and Harry on the street and said, by the way, do you know that we're going to Mali to deploy and part of the MINUSMA mission? And they're probably like, what's MINUSMA? I don't know. Where's Mali? You know, so I think it's also about, and of course, yes, there are obvious challenges with educating the public. I acknowledge that. But I think there is an argument for, you know, if politicians are complaining about, well, there's too much risk aversion, it's actually, well, understand what the public think.
Absolutely.
As much as you can. And get buy-in from Parliament as well about, and I know, Josh, you've said there's a largely cross-party consensus, and I do agree with that. But I think that's also a consideration that should be thought about in this review.
I couldn't agree more.
But
I think the challenge of educating the public isn't as great as some people seem to think. The general public, you know, they understand stuff. They can grasp complexity. They get that. And I think it's merely a question of us being more explicit and more defined. Why are we sending British troops in harm's way to Mali? What is the purpose? How does it relate to UK national security? Now, all three of us in this room could come up with a rationale, but actually it's the government that's got to do that. And so one of the things that I think would be really great to see come out of this review, and I say this at every review, and no, you know, it never happens, and I'm sure it never will, which is that you take both the review itself and the funding streams that support the implementation of that review, and you take both of those documents and you put them to a vote in Parliament. You get the select committees to look at them, they make their recommendations, and then you stick it, you know, you give MPs a chance to vote on it so that Parliament is committed. It's the People's Parliament, so that should be fine. Especially the funding. I mean, the other thing about reviews is follow the money. Always follow the money. Which you can't, because they never release the funding figures until years later. But that's what a lot of the internal discussions will be about.
Absolutely.
So I think I'll go on to the final question. So what are you worried that the 2020 review will leave out? Is there anything in particular you worry that just won't be included in the review?
I think to Josh's point, in a way, it's not necessarily that something's not... I mean, obviously we want them to consider the implications of remote warfare and take all our reports and, you know, raise our profile. It'd be fantastic. But I think what I don't want to see is what happened with the mini review, which was, I know that it was slightly different context, but it became a debate around money, in a very unuseful debate around money as well. Because, you know, there was this push from the National Security Advisor, Sir Mark Sedwell, now Cabinet Secretary and double hatting as the National Security Advisor, that it wasn't going to be about money. It was just, well, what are the, you know, an assessment of the threats, right? How have the threats changed? And of course, then there were concerns that meant that the MOD was going to lose out, that it meant there wasn't going to be any more money, that there'd be cuts, sort of moving figures around and money around rather than actually investing more in it. But I think what then happened was it became a discussion about, well, if you can get additional funding, then that's great, and then we've achieved everything we need to achieve. Well, actually, I think what's good about this review, and I hope does happen, is that it's about what are our ambitions as a country, and then how do we meet those ambitions with the available funding that we have. Now, it might be the case, as I think is always the case with the UK, is that our ambitions outmatch how much money we've got to actually fund that ambition. But I think that's, I don't want it just simply be about, well, more money's good, less money's bad, same money is also bad. And actually, then people just think, well, if you increase the budget for MOD, then it's an achievement. Well, you know, and similarly with FCO and DFID. I don't think it is. I think it's about also having an important discussion about what is the role of the Foreign Office? What should the budget be for the Foreign Office? And of course, these difficult questions about what is the role of DFID? Should it be a standalone department? We need to get to the bottom of that, because I don't think it's fair either to NGOs and DFID to have that sort of hanging in the balance. I think we need to be clear after this review, as part of this review, what is the government's position on the FCO and DFID? So I think that some of the issues that I would say are the challenges, the concerns I have about the sort of the way this review will go.
Maybe if I can just jump in there and add as well, I think 2018 and the small review we saw, the mini review, also saw this complete like falling apart of fusion, where there was not a single review, but the departments did their own. It became this very departmentalized process, and that would be an issue as well, I think. What about you? What do you think is the main risk, Josh?
Well, I think the main risk is that they revert to emotion. And I think one of the things that you see in reviews is they, you know, the end process and sometimes the internal processes are based upon emotion. We will have an aircraft carrier, and often that debate isn't necessarily based on reason. I think there is a very good rational case for an aircraft carrier, but emotion is not good enough. We, you know, saying we want to be a force for good. Define what you mean by force. Define what you mean by good.
Yeah.
You know, we understand these arguments and explain it to people. You know, it is about the use of rationality. And I think the other, I suppose, and the big risk I see of in this area is that there's an almost emotional response amongst certain people towards the issue of free trade and leaving the EU, that somehow, just as Norman, the great Norman Angell, who wrote The Grand Illusion right in the run-up to the First World War, argued that warfare was going to be ended by globalization, by global trade. It's the same mistake that was made by Nixon with China. He thought bringing China into the fold would make it somehow nice. That idea that globalization, the globalization of the international economy, is going to make the world a peaceful place is demonstrably untrue. And the sooner we accept that and move on and look at other, you know, what we really need to do to make the world a more peaceful place, better.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much to both of you. I think that was a great discussion. It was really interesting to hear both of your perspectives on this.
No worries. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to all of our listeners for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did. For those who want to read more in depth about the topics we covered, we put links to any research and publications that we have mentioned in the episode notes. If you want to stay up to date with the Remote Warfare Program and the Oxford Research Group, you can subscribe by clicking on the button at the top of the page. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handles are @OrgInfo and @Remote_Warfare. You can listen to all previous episodes of our podcast free of charge by following the link at the top of the page. We look forward to you joining us soon.